Matt Segundo here, once again relegated to the dust heap of insignificance because of this Litblog co-op business. Thankfully, this nonsense is now at an end, in large part because I tortured Jorge with 6 hours of Edward Lear. Anyway, this week's guest is Kirsten Allio. She is the author of Garner, which garnered, if you'll pardon the noxious pun, the LBC Read This Award for the winter of 2005. The book has no relation to James Garner, thank the good Lord Beelzebub, but tells the story of a murder in 1920s New Hampshire, which I suppose is a bit like the Rockford Files, except it's more literary. But I'll let the exuberant man who follows me spill the beans. Now excuse me while I drink myself into a self-conscious stupor.
19 lip bloggers, 1 finalist, 5 nominees, 1, finalist, 5 authors, 1 podcaster, 5 Mondays, 5 interviews, 1 podcasts. Anyway, the hell with it. It's the LBC Podcast!
So I have Dan Wickets on the line here with, he nominated Kirsten Allio's Garner for this round of the LBC. So Dan, what was it about Garner that sort of struck your fancy? What made you nominate it?
I think the thing that grabbed me right away was how well she being Kirsten Allio, the author, transported me into very early 20th century New Hampshire, something that I really was never familiar with or even thought I'd be interested in at all. And it's one of those books that when it arrived in the mail, I happened to be running out of the house that day, and I grabbed it and took it with me and got stuck in a couple of lines and started it and ended up putting it down at about 1 in the morning.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I just read it straight through. I really, it grabbed a hold. I couldn't put it down.
Okay, well, what was it that, about it that sort of grabbed you exactly?
I guess the fact that she was able to pull me into an area that I never really would have expected to have been interested in, and keep my attention, and create this story, and continue to tell it from different points of view, and just between all that, I guess it kept my attention.
Okay. Well, Dan Wickett, thank you very much, and thank you very much for picking this book. I liked it myself.
Sure. Okay. Glad you enjoyed it as well.
Yes. My life has been a poor attempt. For God's sake, Ed, what were you thinking? It's Dan Wickett, not Dan Fogelberg!
Hello out there in Webland. This is the 5th and final LBC podcast. I hope you have been enjoying these. I'm going to keep it short and sweet. This week, we interview our finalist, Kirsten Allio, author of the LBC award-winning title, Garner. Now this, I must assure you, is a fantastic book, filled with ambiguities. I do not shit you at all. I actually voted a 10 for this book. I was so impressed by it and so moved by the interconnectedness of all the characters, by the amazing sort of stylistic voice that is within this book. And I encourage you, if you have not yet got your hands on this book, to definitely read it. It is a really fantastic mystery. And more than that, it also depicts life as it is in the 1920s. And it'll get you to think. So I'm just going to go ahead and shut up right now and go ahead and let the interview start. But hopefully you've been enjoying these things. If you have any feedback whatsoever on any of these podcasts, I'm happy to hear it. You can email me at ed@edrants.com, and hopefully we'll hear from you. Anyway, without further ado, here is Kirsten Allio.
Okay, I am here with Kirsten Allio, author of the LBC nominee Garner. Kirsten, how are you doing today?
I'm good, thanks, Dad. How are you?
I'm doing fantastic. The last author I spoke to, I hadn't slept, so I'm grateful that I actually got some sleep to be reasonably fresh. So, anyway, I wanted to first of all ask you a question. Do you believe in the ideal of the perfect sentence?
Oh, yeah, sure. Okay. I never thought about it that way, but do I believe in the perfect sentence? Yes, I do.
Okay, do you take steps then to, I mean, how long do you labor over a sentence? I mean, the prose in Garner is so scintillating that I had to ask that question.
Huh, okay. Well, yeah, I mean, I think a sentence is sort of a microcosm, and I think if you don't get the sentences perfect, the whole thing is never going to have a chance. So, yes, I labor over my sentences and try to make them as strong as possible.
I'm wondering if you could... If you can actually accept an imperfect sentence within any of your work.
You know, I guess unfortunately what happens is sometimes a perfect sentence on one day is not so perfect on another day. So in that sense, yes, it sometimes happens.
Okay. Well, okay. we'll talk more about this.
I can't imagine that. I mean, well,
continue.
What a horrible person would say that every sentence was perfect. So I can't go there.
No. I don't see any stigma here. I'm just kind of getting a sense for the level of craftsmanship that you put into your work, which is clear, I think, from Garner. But I guess I wanted to sort of get a sense of the level of tweaking you do within your fiction to get that kind of amazing sort of clarity, and whether, you know, in the process, how, I mean, it's got to be, I mean, you sort of strike me, I guess, I'm guessing out of the blue here that you're a big perfectionist, I would say. Would you say that so, or?
Yeah, I mean, I certainly lean hard on sentences and words and, you know, the poetry of it for sure. I mean,
yeah.
I don't know if I'm a perfectionist, but I think maybe I'm more of a poet than, than a fiction writer, maybe. So in that sense, yeah, every word is important, and I do labor long and hard. But on the other hand, of course, some of those sentences that, I mean, it's just like anything else in life, you know. Sometimes when you're caught off guard, or you do something spontaneously, or you're surprised or shocked into doing something, that's your best work, of course, too. So, I don't know.
Well, I'll go ahead and get off this topic. But anyway, the sense I got from Garner was that you were almost channeling sort of the vast realm of Faulkner by creating this town. But what you did, which is not a tricky thing to do at all, is that you went with the New Hampshire angle, and you almost completely divested yourself of the Faulknerian stamp. Like, for example, if you look at a book like Brad Watson's The Heaven of Mercury, which is a similar kind of situation, it still carries that Faulknerian sort of imprint. But what you did, you know, it seems that it sort of stands on its own as a form of distinctiveness. And I'm beyond the heavy research you did, I'm wondering what exercises you did as a fiction writer to allow this prose to sound so sparkling and so distinct and so, on its own. Or was Faulkner an influence, or?
Well, not specifically to Garner. I mean, I certainly revere Faulkner. Oh my goodness. I'm not quite sure what your question is, but
it's kind of a big baggy monster of a question. But essentially, I'm just trying to determine again what you did to make Garner so distinct, so unique and standing on its own in terms of its tone and in terms of its structure and in terms of, like, the feel of it. It's just really, for me anyway, it struck me as a very unconventional feel from the usual kind of contemporary fiction I read, and I it was very remarkable. So I'm wondering if you could kind of describe how you went about that process to get that.
I mean, I'm going to sort of veer off here because
that's fine.
I'm not quite sure how to answer it, but
I just want to.
Sure. I mean, I got so much inspiration from my research, and not necessarily facts and all of that, but just from the source material and from those strange now syntax and cadences, and it's almost like reading something. I found that it was reading the historical material was like reading something like badly translated or something really other, and I tried to let it. I tried then not to make another translation, just to sort of let it be. So maybe, I don't know, maybe that's the, maybe that's what you, what you, what you're picking up, or,
I think maybe what I'm getting at here is because you did all this research to set the work in 1925, it feels as if it's in 1925, or it feels kind of remote from current vernacular and the way people speak and the way things read. And I'm wondering if outside of the research there were any factors to go ahead that you used to get that particular tone.
Oh, boy. Yeah, sure. I mean, you're... I have some spinster aunts who are very
oh yeah
who are not actually some of them who have passed away are that old, but I tried to open my ears and you know my parents do live in New Hampshire and I part of my childhood was spent there, so just even going back and listening again, and of course they don't talk like that anymore. And, mm-hmm. You know, they're trying desperately to be in the modern age. But I found the deeper I got into the novel, the easier it was for me to sort of look through a lens of history and see the whole landscape and the whole humanscape in that way. I don't know.
I think you kind of were starting to hit upon it. I mean, for example, I was particularly keen and interested in the Mrs. Heald character, who seemed to be one of the most personal and kind of conflicted characters in the book. Did your spinster aunts and your family kind of inspire this character? I'm wondering where she came from.
Oh, she's my favorite, too.
Oh, really?
Yeah, people don't pay so much attention to her, but a book club that I spoke to who was reading the book in New Jersey, they were all these very smart and somewhat frustrated professional women, kind of housewife type, who had had careers. And they were irate that over my treatment of women, and how could I paint such a bleak, you know, how could I give women in Garner no choices? And I really, I think, never occurred to me, and I certainly didn't do it on purpose, didn't keep Frances down.
Yeah.
But Mrs. Held, or Heald, is, I think she's a little bit wise in her way, and that's why I like her a lot. So was she like my spinster aunt? Sure, a little bit, although definitely a composite, not anyone in particular.
So it's Held, not Heald, then?
Pardon me?
It's Held, not Heald, then?
Either one.
Okay.
Yeah.
I guess I thought Heald because there were allusions in this book to, well, I saw Heald and Columbine, and part of me was wondering if this was kind of an allegory for modern, you know, reference points.
Yes. Yes. Well, actually, in New Hampshire, they do say Heald. So you're right.
Well, no, actually, though, I mean, if it's Held, then we're going to go ahead and have a campaign right now.
I don't know. I think hands off. I'm done.
Okay. Well, I mean, going back to Mrs. Held, the thing that actually made me interested in her was that I saw a lot of parallels between, you know, some professional women and particularly older women that I know who are kind of sort of, even in the 21st century, precluded from actually, like, you know, allowing their intelligence to kind of spill over and to take command of their lives. And so there are a lot of parallels I saw with that. And I'm wondering, you know, and in fact, the whole sort of your portrayal of women in this book, I found to be, you know, very, very interesting and quiet. And the thing that also, and I'm going to, you know, go off on a complete tangent here, but the thematic dichotomies in the book. You have modern versus contemporary, small town versus big city, restrained women versus liberated women. And that's quite a lot for a 200-page novel. And I'm wondering... though it's very, very nuanced the way that you do it, and I'm wondering if it is impossible for you to pen fiction without those nuances. How do they come about throughout the course of the drafts?
They're layered over many, many, many drafts. I think I just write. I don't know how many drafts other people write, but I think I must generate, you know, just like 30,000 pages or something.
Wow.
I mean, I, So it's definitely, the nuances are for sure a layering process. But I'm very, I'm very interested in economy and compression,
mm-hmm.
and which goes back to the importance of a single sentence again too. I mean, I want all those big themes, and I want to ask all those big questions, but I don't want to take a long time to do it. So, I don't want you to have to read for a long time to get my questions.
Yeah, no, I get you. But at the same time, you know, it's like reading Garner, I felt like mesmerized. I felt as if I was like, you know, in some sort of warm bath that I couldn't quite leave, you know.
So, without
giving you too much information, no. But anyway, where I was going with this was, I'm wondering, was there a specific sort of initial theme that came up in the early drafts? You know, how did the world kind of sort of come into being?
Yeah. Well, it started out as a contemporary novel.
Mm-hmm. Really?
Although the idea was, I sort of cast about, I wanted to show that the small town really has changed over the course of time, and it was much more sort of focused on women's plight, which thank God I moved away from in the end, because it's so boring. But it was much more, I mean, it was much more a coming of age novel, and the rape was much more central, and I had a lot more sort of hot headed things to say about it, and it was the sense that, you know, women in particular go through the same shitty lives century after century after century.
Yeah.
But the contemporary sections, which was the bulk of it, just kept not ringing true. And I found, I found that that if I set it back in time, it helped me to step away from it too and just see so much more clearly. More of a bird's eye view, and it gave the whole thing room to breathe, and it rang truer to me. So let's see, to steer me back to where you.
No, you're doing just fine. Did going further back in the past kind of? You were mentioning that it kind of helped you to focus. Did you find that contemporary settings were too much of an obstruction towards what you were concentrating upon, or?
I found that they were very limiting, and they didn't have sort of a classical or a universal resonance that I was going for.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a hell of a time with contemporary dialogue. Period.
Well, but I also have to say, Kirsten, it was kind of nice to read the dialogue in 1925. It felt that I was sort of entering sort of, you know, some interesting kind of conduits of communication that I don't normally see, and I think that's one of the appeals of the book.
Yeah, well, the other thing is, it was easier, I mean, I wanted to show the incredible restraint and, you know, the Puritan ethics and the repression, really, of those New Englanders, and that for sure was easier to show in this alternate time period. So,
Well, I understand from an interview that you did with Dan Wickett, who I think might actually be interviewing you again. I don't know. He's
No,
you're doing okay. But that you actually sent this work to Coffee House without an agent.
I did. Yes,
I'm wondering
very
if you,
lucky.
Yeah. Well, I'm wondering though if you could speculate on why agents are sort of intimidated by the idea of literary fiction. You know, it does actually have an audience. It is saleable in its own particular way. Something like Garner can, in fact, find an audience. Certainly, it allowed all of us here at the Lit Block Co-op to go completely nuts over it. So,
wow, thank you so much. It's really, I mean, it's so great that I don't even know any of you.
Wow.
You don't know me, and you just, you know, stumbled upon it, really, and it's great. I think agents were intimidated because they, I did have an agent actually,
uh-huh.
who loved it, but editors were not, you know, they couldn't sort of get a handle on it, and some editors really wanted wanted me to, you know, to simplify it and to make it much more conventional, and I didn't want to do that.
Really?
And, I mean, I think this is just, it's, unfortunately, this, it's an old story. It's just, people aren't taking very big risks at all. And I think also editors and agents aren't very good at, if they want to be able to have a one-liner or align it with some other author or whatever they do with it, they're not really very good at it.
Mm-hmm.
So,
do you think, like, for example, though, like a lot of contemporary literature, you know, it's more sort of impressionistic. Like, for example, I'm a big admirer of David Mitchell, but even I'll confess that to some degree his problem is that he's a fantastic stylist, but he's also an impressionist.
Yeah.
Whereas, I don't know, I got the sense with Garner that you were sort of, you know, going beyond being an impressionist and wanting to sort of tap into the visceral. Why do you think contemporary literature doesn't go that extra mile?
Good question. I don't know.
Are MFA workshops partly to blame? Or?
Oh, boy, you're putting words in my mouth.
No, I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. I don't know. I don't think I can very well answer that on short notice. I'd have to give it some thought.
Well, I also think, though, people who are reading Garner don't actually, they may not know that you were also involved in an experimental fiction project called Gray Matters.
No, I don't think they do know that.
Yeah, and which...
You know that. Nobody knows that.
Well, I just happen to know things.
Okay.
But I'm wondering, you know, I'm wondering, though, since that was such a complete, you know, if you compare Gray Matters, what I saw of it, to Garner... It's almost a completely different you, and I'm wondering how much time it takes you in the course of a project to shake off a voice or to possibly find a new kind of very specific voice. It strikes me, do you submerge yourself completely in something until you kind of it kind of becomes distinct? Or,
mm-hmm. Well, Gray Matters. I mean, I'm mortified that you've seen any of it.
Oh well.
Because I was a college student. Come on. No, and Garner. I mean, yeah. I certainly submerge myself, but actually, Garner was written over a long period of time, and especially in I've just had two kids in the last 5 years, and
yeah.
That's really informed the way I work. Actually, funnily enough, for the better. So I'm just much more focused now because I'm basically a stay-at-home mother. You don't want to hear all this, but. So I really, my time is so precious, and I use it very well.
Yeah.
Let's see. So do I submerge myself? I almost think I don't submerge myself. I almost think, sort of the opposite. I can come in and out pretty easily, though.
Huh.
And that gives me a lot of energy for writing to come in and out. There's sort of around it that I find works well for me.
Well, let's talk about your literary influences. I'm wondering if Wallace Stegner was a factor when
writing. Oh, God, yeah. Well, yeah, especially the short stories, actually.
Uh-huh. Well, what other literary...
Very much so, yes.
What other influences did you have for Garner?
Well, Michael Ondaatje, and you asked about Faulkner, and I think more Michael Ondaatje even in terms of form, sort of alternate forms that novels can take. And there's this great book, On the Black Hill, by Bruce Chatwin.
That sounds vaguely familiar.
Oh, God, you should read it. If you liked Garner, this will just blow you out of the water.
Okay. Okay.
So it's about, you know, repressed farm folk in a bleak landscape. it's a novel, and for him, who also I like his writing very much because it's so sort of porous between, it's I don't know what it is, autobiography, stream of consciousness, fiction, everything. And On the Black Hill is more of a sort of conventional novel, but it's very fine. And I always go back to Flannery O'Connor and Ethan Frome, of course.
Mm-hmm.
This for Garner. I mean, big Edith Wharton fan, but Ethan Frome certainly gave me a leg up. And, oh, many, I mean, I try to read as much as I can. Just read and read and read.
Gotcha.
So, but those Wallace Stegner short stories, and Alastair MacLeod, too, who's a Canadian writer.
Yes.
Same kind of really restrained, reserved, sort of odd, gothic almost stories about man and nature.
It's interesting, too, that you had sort of like this kind of slight literary kind of subculture emerge within within Garner, with the whole Robert Yates character. Although, I have to ask you this. There was a serial killer in Spokane called Robert Yates.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
I didn't know if it was an explicit allusion to that, or if it was...
No, I have no idea.
Oh, really? No. Or if it was possibly a reference to either Robert Frost or Richard Yates or some sort of...
No. It just sounded right.
Really?
No. And actually, my first name for that character, which I was very attached to, was much more of a New England-y name, was shot down because it was some... I grew up without a television, so I'm sort of like... Popular culture is just... It's not my forte, and apparently it was some major hero from the 70s from some TV show. So,
what was the name?
It sounded good. I can't even remember now.
Oh, no. Okay, well...
It was... Oh, ask me again.
It wasn't Starsky or Hutch.
No. I'm not that bad.
Okay.
Not that bad.
Well, I mean, I don't really watch TV these days, too. I just learned the other day that Cato Kalin actually had a TV show. I had no idea. I don't watch this thing. Well, how do names kind of come to you? The names in this are very... I really like them, and I'm wondering what... You mentioned that it feels right. I talked a bit with Octavia Butler about this, and she had, like, lists of names. I was wondering what kind of process that you actually go through.
Yeah, I make lists. I love names. It's a reason, I mean, I'm not going to have any more children, but I'd almost have four more just to get to name them. I do. I make lists, and a lot of these names I took from, you know, from graveyards and sort of composites of more sort of historical names. But Francis was one of my great aunt's names.
Uh-huh.
And so that's, I don't know.
Wait, so you actually walked graveyards to get names? Or?
Oh, yeah.
Really?
Graveyards are so great in New England. I don't know what you guys have out there in California.
Well, we have graveyards. So,
yeah.
You know, well, here in San Francisco, you have to go to south to we have all these very beautiful cemeteries, about 50 miles south, that's actually a very fantastic idea, actually.
And then you sort of get, I don't know, you get a mood and a vibe too, and you're not supposed to do grave rubbings anymore because it eats away the stone, but
yeah,
sometimes you could do that too.
I'm wondering if the shape of the marker or the tombstone might actually sort of affect your word choice.
Yes. On some level.
Well, the other thing that was interesting too was Francis's development into womanhood in this novel. It represents a kind of perspective that I think, in framing it in 1925, it's something that we kind of sometimes forget about. And I'm wondering, you know, if you can kind of talk about how that kind of specific or that explicit womanhood was kind of, you know, was built up over the course of the many drafts that you wrote.
Oh, let's see. Francis is coming of age.
Yeah.
Which is really, again, where I started the novel, so it's hard for me to... it just feels so sort of long ago. I think what's central about coming of age, of course, is inner conflict, and I wanted to show that about Frances, and that she was at once, you know, this sort of child of the woods and child of nature and natural Diana and all that stuff,
mm-hmm.
And also of all the characters, she was the one who should have gotten out.
Yeah.
And you know, of course, I mean, obviously, that she was attracted to Robert Yates and yet was ashamed by that attraction. And then, so I tried to... It's really, it's really tricky, though, writing about girlhood.
Yeah.
And without, of course, being, you know, totally sentimental. And so I tried to, I guess I tried to have a light touch and sort of let her,
but I think, I think,
rather than, you know, rather than force her into being something. Because I think, I mean, I think that's so, so much of the secret of writing is not to tell the whole thing. To stop just before you've told the whole thing, maybe. To hold back so there's room for the reader to interpret. And that's what's so exciting about being a reader. And that's, I think, why you think, why one thinks something is good is because of what one brings to it. That's a hypertext concept for you. But yeah, I do think that.
Well, you actually, it was interesting because it was rooted in both sort of like the way you framed the plot as well as the way you described the action, which was largely dialogue, largely sort of, you know, being in trees and the like. And so we're allowed to, you know, the reader, at least this reader here, is allowed to make all manner of, you know, possible sort of conclusions from this. And yet, at the same time, I got the sense when reading your book that not all of my conclusions were necessarily right. There are no easy answers in this book.
Well, that's good. I hope that. And I did, I mean, and right, I want, I mean, on a certain level, I wanted it to be just exactly that, ambiguous.
Sure. Well, life is ambiguous, so.
Yeah.
Oh, I wonder, how long exactly did it take you to write Garner? You mentioned that it took a lot of drafts, a lot of words, but.
Yeah, well, I mean, it was really, I started it when I was getting my MFA at Brown, so, you know, seven years ago, 8 years ago.
Yeah.
And I sort of worked on it through that time, and then I, after that, I got another master's degree in education, and of course I didn't touch it during that time. And then I had little children, so on and off. But I finished it at, I finished it about 2.5 or 3 years ago. So I don't know.
How long did it take you to get a publisher for this?
Pardon me?
I said, how long did it take you to get Coffee House for this?
How long did it take them to respond to me? A long time,
oh,
actually.
Gotcha.
I guess I sent a letter and it was probably, that's a good question, maybe 3 months or something until I heard, which I think is sort of standard.
Yeah, okay. Are you working on anything right now, or?
Yes, of course. I mean, I finished this really so long ago that I have a novel that I'm playing around with, and but I'm really challenged by some short stories right now, and I'm sort of finding that I'm working on craft and technique in a way that I haven't ever done before. So that's fun for me.
Huh. Oh, so you're working on short stories, I guess, to kind of try to confine yourself even further, or?
Yeah, maybe that's it. Yeah. I'm working on short stories because it's one of those periods where I have to let the novel rest.
Yeah.
But I'm also working on them because I suddenly believe in craft and technique, and I kind of didn't believe in it before. I thought it was all like the muse. And I don't think it's used much at all anymore. So, the short story form. Well, it's just so much shorter. I can actually see from beginning to end, you know, in a month rather than in 3 years. So,
well, why were you initially skeptical about craft? Do you think?
I think maybe just lassitude. I think I was lazy.
Huh.
I'm not sure. And because it felt so good to write when I was sort of inspired.
Yeah.
And it didn't feel, I mean, I was just, I have a very sketchy sort of academic past. I dropped out of high school and this, that, and the other thing. And I never learned to write a 5-paragraph essay. And I sort of got stalled there.
Wow.
So now I feel like I could maybe circle around back to that and, and that things just maybe I wouldn't have to make so many drafts if I learned some, you know, some shortcuts. And, we'll see. I don't know.
Okay. Well, Kirsten, it was a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you. I hope I didn't make you too nervous here.
No, well, you did, but that's okay. I'm all right. Yes, I'm relieving, now that you're leaving.
It's our